Hello and welcome to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending May the 9th, 2020. My name's Ian, I edit and produce the programme. As you know, during the current pandemic crisis, we have deemed it unsafe to use our usual studio at Radio Verulam, so this edition is once again being produced at home. You are also not able to access the programme on the USB stick we usually send you, so the full-length programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Just search for Talking Newspaper. Once you've installed the app, open it up, select East of England, then scroll down until you find the two entries for St Albans. You can also hear the news from the Hertfordshire Advertiser and the Review on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM in a programme ably hosted by our very own Rob Pearman on Thursdays at 7 p.m, repeated on Sunday also at 7 p.m. He also hosts Local Life Extra on Wednesdays at 7. So, in this edition, we'll have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. Rupert Evershed will be reading his nature notes. And, with the anniversary of VE Day just gone by, my old friend Alastair Stewart will be giving his own personal view of the Cenotaph War Memorial in London, as part of the Vocalise London Beyond Sight project. I believe that Robin, the previous producer of this programme, used to use other items from this project, so I hope you find it interesting. As well, I'll be reading from a 1963 guide to St Albans in the 60s. And to finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdays in the week. This week's music is Piano Swing Blues by Goffby. But first, the news, read by Gilly, Steve, Wendy and myself. And you'll notice that a couple of the stories refer to VE Day, Friday the 8th of May. But I hope you'll still find them interesting.
Cathedral lit up in NHS blue to join Clap for Carers. St Albans' iconic cathedral is being illuminated in NHS blue, and the bells will be ringing out to join the nation's Clap for Carers. Although the cathedral is closed to the public, the team have been working behind the scenes to ensure it paid tribute to frontline NHS staff, carers and key workers each week. The Dean of St Albans, the Very Reverend Dr Geoffrey John, said, "We are very glad we can play our bells remotely and light up the cathedral in blue on Thursday evenings as a sign of appreciation and thanks on behalf of the whole community. We are moved by all those who are working selflessly to help others, especially staff in the NHS and care homes, those who keep our shops, transport and deliveries going, and people who simply go out of their way to make sure their neighbours are safe and cared for. This is a hard time, but it really does bring out the best in people, and we all want to say thank you." Councillor Mandy McNeil, District Council Portfolio Holder for Business, Culture and Tourism, added, "The stunning images of our historic St Albans Cathedral lit up in blue, going out to the world on social media, combined with the sound of bells ringing out across our city, brought stroke brings our community even closer together to honour the hard work and sacrifice of our frontline key workers, the NHS and carers." And County Councillor Annie Brewster, Executive Deputy Member for Public Health and Prevention, said, "There can be no better sound to bring our city together than St Albans Cathedral's bells. It is immensely fitting that the bells in the 11th century tower give thanks to our heroic key workers. At such an anxious time, the reassurance from a landmark that has witnessed and survived challenging times over thousands of years is wonderful. What is more, 21st century technology allows the additional impressive visual homage of NHS blue floodlighting. Fabulous."
Hello, Steve here, and my first story is Family Saves Tree Planting Project at their local primary school in lockdown. A plan for the local community to plant over 400 trees at a St Albans primary school was nearly cancelled because of the lockdown, but the project has been saved thanks to the actions of one family. Last year, Mount Pleasant Primary School applied to the Woodland Trust charity for the gift of 420 trees to be planted as part of a bigger environmental project at the school, which was to raise awareness of the importance of growing trees for carbon capture, as well as measuring air pollution around the school area. There were also plans to get the pupils to growing their own vegetables. Before the lockdown, the project was planned to involve local people, bringing parents, pupils and neighbours together for a community planting event. Now, Sustainable St Albans volunteer and parent Suzanne Dolan, husband Scott and children Jessica, 9, and Jensen, 5, have been working hard to ensure the Woodland Trust trees get planted out in the school grounds. Suzanne Dolan said, "We were determined that these trees were going to be saved." The bigger plan had been to engage parents and pupils in a wider understanding of environmental issues, as well as the dangerous issue of air pollution, by encouraging parking further away from the school gates, asking parents to switch off engines while waiting, and to consider using bicycles and walking to get to school. The Dolan family, who are practicing social distancing, have been planting the trees along the front perimeter fence of the school, which has involved lifting and replanting daffodil bulbs as they go. Scott said, "It was only right that we spent this time salvaging what we could of this project. It's been hard work, but good exercise for all the family during the lockdown." Head teacher Victoria Berman said, "The family were the only people given access to the school during lockdown," and added, "It's very good that parents have stepped in to ensure the school's environmental project will succeed." Local business, Burston Garden Centre, have also helped by donating vegetable seedlings that are now being grown by key workers' children attending the school.
Hello, my name is Wendy, and my first story is The Cathedral joins Big Picnic for Hope as part of the VE Day 75th anniversary celebrations. St Albans Cathedral is joining with cathedrals across England to mark the 75th anniversary of VE Day. Heroes past and present will be remembered in a special service to be broadcast on YouTube and as part of the Big Picnic for Hope project, which asks people to stay at home, to picnic indoors or in their gardens, and to join friends and families virtually. The Very Reverend Geoffrey John, Dean of St Albans, said, "In most of history's wars, it is hard to say which side was in the right. The Second World War was different. Nazism was a dehumanizing ideology based on a perverted evolutionary theory that one race is naturally superior to another, and that therefore be justified in crushing and exterminating others. The defeat of Hitler was a straightforward victory of good over evil. It is something of which this country can be genuinely proud and for which we should be grateful to our forebears and to God. To mark VE Day, we will be streaming a special service of thanksgiving, including contributions from some of those who took part in the struggle, a message from the Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, and a sermon from Bishop Stephen Venner, who until recently was Bishop to the Armed Forces. The planned street picnics and celebrations are impossible this year, but the Big Picnic for Hope is a national initiative to gather us together in homes and over social media. The idea is to celebrate not only the past, but also the courage and spirit of the individuals and communities who are struggling now with the pandemic. The NHS staff, carers, cleaners, drivers, shop workers, everybody who is doing their bit. And as we eat our picnic, there is also a chance to contribute to food banks for others. Cathedrals around the country had events planned to form part of the national celebrations marking the VE Day anniversary. These events would have brought together communities, friends and families in gatherings and street parties around the UK. However, with the COVID-19 pandemic, such gatherings are no longer possible. Most major events have been cancelled or postponed. But May the 8th is still a national bank holiday, and the Big Picnic for Hope offers an opportunity to reflect on past events and those we are all currently experiencing. It also gives the nation another way of saying thank you for the incredible effort and sacrifice being made by our key workers, from carers, delivery personnel, grocery workers, public transport workers, to medical researchers and frontline NHS staff. The project also aims to raise £5,000 towards the Trussell Trust, a charity supporting a network of food banks and helping those in need in the UK. Samantha Stapley, Chief Operating Officer at the Trussell Trust, said, "As the coronavirus outbreak develops, more people are likely to need a food bank's help. Our teams are working tirelessly to ensure that food banks are able to remain open and have the necessary stocks to respond to the crisis. The support of the Cathedral Network means we can remain agile to respond to the fast-changing situation and ensure food banks continue to provide the lifeline of emergency food and additional support for people in crisis. Thank you." People can share their plans and ideas for the Big Picnic for Hope using the hashtag Big Picnic for Hope. On social media, people will be able to share and see their creative ideas of what to bake, what to make, how to picnic in style. The fundraising page can be found at www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Big Picnic for Hope.
Minor Injuries Unit is to remain closed in response to the coronavirus outbreak. St Albans City Hospital's Minor Injuries Unit will remain closed throughout May as part of the ongoing coronavirus response. The MIU was closed as a temporary measure on Friday, April the 3rd, so that staff could be redeployed to support the care of patients elsewhere within the West Harts Hospitals Trust, including COVID-19 patients needing critical care. While the number of new COVID-19 cases is decreasing, the clinical needs of current patients are high, and staff absence through either sickness or self-isolation also remains higher than normal. In view of this, the MIU will remain closed, and the Trust and CCG will review the position at the end of May. The Trust and CCG are working closely together on plans for a safe resumption of some services, and urgent care services are part of that. Patients needing help with minor injuries can attend the Urgent Treatment Centre, UTC, at Hemel Hempstead Hospital. The UTC is open from 8 a.m. until 10 p.m. and can treat a wide range of non-emergency illnesses and injuries, and is able to safely manage any additional capacity resulting from the continued closure of the MIU. Before attending the UTC, patients with minor injuries are advised to visit 111.nhs.uk for advice on where to go for their symptoms. Patients can also call their GP practice for healthcare advice and support. GPs are working mainly over the telephone or via video consultations at the moment to help patients and staff stay safe. GPs can still see patients face-to-face if there is a medical reason to do so, but this will be determined by telephone triage or video consultation first. Patients who have sustained serious injuries and suffering blood loss or a serious deterioration should call 999. No one with COVID-19 symptoms should attend any medical setting unless explicitly directed to do so by the NHS 111 service or the 999 call operator. At the time of writing, May the 5th, 295 patients in West Harts Hospitals Trust had died as a result of coronavirus, and 118 in neighbouring East and North Harts NHS Trust. For further information and guidance, go to www.westhartshospitals.nhs.uk.
House burglaries and thefts down in St Albans over the year, councillors are told. According to the latest figures, there were 345 house burglaries in the district between April 2019 and March 2020. That is 30.6% lower than the 497 break-ins reported during the previous 12 months. The figures show there has also been a marked decrease in the number of thefts from motor vehicles, with 226 fewer offences across the district compared to last year. There have also been reductions in offences of robbery, theft, public order crimes, drugs offences and offences against persons with injury. However, the figures do show there was an increase in burglaries at commercial and business premises in the district, which increased by 7.3% from 192 to 206. There was reported to have been a slight increase in the number of recorded offences relating to violence without injury, sexual offences, and the possession of weapons. The number of domestic violence reports rose from 1,018 in 2018/19 to 1,169 in 2019/20, with the report suggesting this will rise further. The situation will only be exacerbated by the current restrictions on movement prompted by the COVID-19 pandemic, says the report. The figures were reported to a meeting of St Albans City and District Council's Cabinet on Thursday, April the 23rd. St Albans is one of six Hertfordshire districts where there has been an overall reduction in crime over the past 12 months. Figures also show that more crimes are being solved, with a slight increase in the overall outcome rate, which now stands at 12.3%. Councillor Jackie Taylor, portfolio holder for protection, said, "It is very satisfying to see the overall level of crime in the district fall. This is in part due to the hard work of the police, who have been supported by us and other organisations in the St Albans District Community Safety Partnership. However, we are not complacent, and the partnership will continue to monitor crime trends and take action to combat any concerns. Over the last year, our team has helped the police in many ways. This has included operating the city centre's CCTV system and responding to incidents such as a spate of serious antisocial behaviour in one particular area of the city, which was brought to a halt."
District celebrates 75 years since victory in Europe in World War II. On Friday, the 8th of May, in 1945, the Allied forces accepted the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany, bringing to an end almost 6 years of war in Europe. Although victory in Japan was still some months away, on May the 8th, Prime Minister Winston Churchill addressed the nation and declared the day a national holiday. As was seen elsewhere in the UK, Victory in Europe Day, VE Day, was celebrated across St Albans with street parties held into the night. Historian Mike Neighbour, whose website, www.stalbansowneastend.org.uk, looks at the east end of the city, recalls being at one of the parties in Woodland Drive. "I was at one of them, though my memory really comes from what my parents had told me, but I was told repeatedly that I was enjoying myself. I was, after all, nearly 2 years old. The party was held between, I think, numbers 29 and 37. A wireless was brought into one of the front gardens, and one householder with a piano entertained the junior troops through the open windows. I know one or two others who would have been there scoffing the sandwiches and jelly, ration-free food for the occasion, would have been Derek Shearman, Tony Dunkley, Mary Grosvenor, Peter Stickland, and Andrew Stone. But don't be surprised if one or two others add themselves to the list. As it was a new road, there were many young families with small children, and the mums with prams especially would have got to know each other through their daily visits to the Fleetville shops to join the queues with their ration books. I'm afraid my parents, though having a camera, didn't record the party." To mark the 75th anniversary of VE Day, residents were encouraged to join St Albans Mayor, Councillor Janet Smith, in a special toast. She raised a glass as part of a national toast for the heroes of the Second World War. With the country in lockdown due to COVID-19, there were no street parties or other large social gatherings to mark the occasion, so the mayor performed the 3 p.m. toast at home and invited everyone in the district to join her at that time. A special VE Day 75 page was created on the Enjoy St Albans website, www.enjoystalbans.com/things-to-do. And on the Enjoy St Albans Facebook page, residents were asked to contribute photographs that captured the spirit of the occasion, with the mayor awarding prizes to the best image. The mayor said at the time, I'm hoping that our residents can come together by joining me in the toast at 3 p.m. to commemorate this turning point in our history. This will be our way of saluting those generations who made so many sacrifices during World War II and had their lives changed forever. We will always be in their debt and should never forget those who lost their lives or suffered terrible injury while protecting the freedoms we enjoy today. I'm asking for residents throughout the district to stand up and toast those heroes on VE Day 75, thanking them for all they did for us. Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Culture and Tourism, said, "We have posted a wealth of information about VE Day on a special webpage, and I hope residents can take a look at it. It can become a focal point for the district at this historic time. Many of our businesses are providing help to people who want to stage a small celebration at home by offering special deliveries of food and other treats. I urge people to make use of that."
Vandalism turned into rainbows by village children. A Redbourne childminder and the children she looks after have stuck rainbow drawings on benches which were vandalised in the village. Nicola Reynard and three-year-old Beatrice hope to spread some joy after noticing the graffiti on a memorial bench, one of 14 that were targeted, along with tombstones and a bus shelter. Officers are now hunting for those responsible for the offensive graffiti, which could result in a charge of criminal damage. The benches, which belonged to Redbourne Parish Council, were defaced over several days. They were situated at different locations in the village, including the common. Several of them were dedicated to the memory of well-known residents, having been funded by their loved ones. They are clearly marked with nameplates. Among the graffiti slogans that were written with a permanent marker was one that said, "Real crisis, fake pandemic, they're destroying our lives." The St Albans City and District Council has offered to erase the writing with the help of its waste contractor, Viola. In the meantime, young children have taken to fixing the problem. Nicola told the Heart Sad, "I was just so sad about the memorial benches being vandalised. Redbourne is the most wonderful village to live in, with a great community spirit, and we all pull together in hard times." Nicola is still able to work during the pandemic with a reduced capacity. "So Monday morning, when the little ones arrived, we got cracking on painting rainbows," she continued. "I laminated them, and we got to work placing them on the vandalised benches. I hope that it's made people smile when they see them, rather than focusing on the awful vandalism." Redbourne Parish Council alerted Hearts Police to the crime, and anyone with information should contact them by calling 101. Chair of the Parish Council, David Mitchell, added, "Fortunately, there is a great community spirit in Redbourne. The Redbourne Care Group and the Redbourne Coronavirus Volunteers have a very robust COVID-19 response team. Anyone who needs to contact them can do so on 01582 794 550.
Support during Ramadan offered to Islamic community. Ramadan during lockdown is going to be a difficult time for St Albans Muslims, with mosques being closed and extended families separated. Trustee of Sopwell Community Trust, Ralhana Ahmed, said, "Ramadan this year will be the hardest in living history. Fasting for 16 hours daily for a month in isolation will be incredibly testing. This is the first time I will not be spending the period with my parents. Ordinarily, we would share information via the Arabic school and mosques." She explained that sometimes families do not access services unless they know somebody involved in the delivery, and so she has picked out key community members and circulated a go-to guide for support services on Facebook. There are more than 20 BME charities working in St Albans, and some are not very well known. The COVID-19 St Albans response group list includes a service delivering emergency food packs accessed through 3 different phone numbers. There is also a PPE supplies community system in place. Additionally, there is a telephone number of where to get help with Muslim burials and Islamic funerals at this difficult time. There is a wide range of support around other difficulties people might be facing, such as prescription collection, benefits guidance, tenancy issues, homeschooling advice, and ways to stay informed of important information about the festival. The 37-year-old of Taylor Close added, "It is customary for Muslims to be discreet in their charity work, and this is often missed. We're encouraging residents to share their acts of kindness with us via Ramadan. Additionally, we're hoping this will inspire others to reach out to neighbours and friends to spread a little cheer. They are also having a competition where children across the district can put a lantern in their window to symbolise light, an inclusive sign of hope for people in these dark times. To find out more about community support during Ramadan and beyond, visit Sopwell Community Trust Facebook page. St Albans has a vibrant, diverse community of Muslims, and support services are inclusive to all, regardless of their faith background."
Scouts in lockdown hold their own St George's Day virtual renewal of promise. St Albans Scouts, Cubs and Beavers held a virtual renewal of promise as part of their annual St George's Day celebrations. Every year, Scouts groups from across the district hold a traditional parade through St Albans city centre on the Sunday closest to April the 23rd, starting at the Auburn Arena and ending up in Verulamium Park. But with families remaining at home for the national lockdown, this year's scouting has had to adapt, with many groups already holding online meetings to continue bringing scouting to their members. It was easy to do the same for their annual celebration. Hertfordshire Scouts County Commissioner Liz Walker said, "For most people on lockdown, April the 23rd was just another Thursday at home. But for the thousands of young Beavers, Cubs, Scouts and Explorers across St Albans and around the world, it holds another meaning to them. St George's Day is when we celebrate scouting. St George is the role model of scouting across the world, who is particularly appropriate this year as we try to keep the part of the Scout law that states a Scout has courage in all difficulties and our promise to help other people." The evening started at 7:30 p.m. with scouting members from across the county joining live online to hear the county commissioner congratulate them and their leaders for continuing scouting during these difficult and challenging times. She also recognised those who have volunteered to help the NHS or their communities in some way. Each section of the movement were then asked to renew their promise together as a show of solidarity and commitment. There were 2,500 plus views live on Facebook and many more watching on Instagram or Zoom. Liz ended the chat with a mention about the Scouts' Hike to the Moon challenge, raising money for the Big Night In appeal. Members were encouraged to hike a mile or more at home and make a donation to the appeal and send in photos or videos of their achievements. The set target amount was £240,000, which was achieved and passed on Friday afternoon. The event concluded with members joining the weekly Clap for Carers on their doorstep in uniform.
Your messages of support for NHS staff and all our key workers. People in St Albans and Harpenden have painted rainbows, clapped from their driveways, and sent personal messages of thanks to honour NHS staff and key workers. Ellie Miller of Ditchling Court in St Albans shaved her head to raise money for the NHS and managed to raise a total of £250. She said, "I thank the NHS for helping me over the last few years due to chronic conditions I have. I would like to say I'm extremely grateful for all your hard work and help, and I will always appreciate what you do." Tiffany Ballard, manager at Nuffy Bear Day Nursery in St Albans, said, "I just want to say a truly huge thank you and praise my whole entire team. They have been truly amazing and have gone above and beyond to continue giving care and comfort to both children in our care and also their families."
Europe Day 2020. Show appreciation for migrant workers. A campaign group urged residents to demonstrate their love for the continent last Saturday in celebration of Europe Day, an annual appreciation of peace and unity. Local grassroots cross-party campaign group St Albans for Europe asked people to show their appreciation for all migrants, including many from the EU, who are playing such a crucial role in helping the UK meet the challenges of the COVID-19 crisis. The group shared individuals' activities on social media on the day itself to highlight the vital contributions that migrants are making to the nation's fight against the virus. Fiona McAndrew, chair of St Albans for Europe, said, "Many of the UK's key workers in the National Health Service, care homes, food supply chain and online delivery networks are from overseas. 65,000 NHS staff in England are EU nationals, accounting for 5.5% of all staff, and overall 13.1% of NHS staff say that their nationality is not British. Our food supply chain is also heavily reliant on overseas workers, and travel restrictions due to COVID-19 mean that farmers have had to put out an urgent call for help to replace these workers." She said Europe Day is the perfect day to thank these valuable key workers, and more this year than in any other year. As the whole world faces the COVID-19 crisis, it is more important than ever to show our immense appreciation for those from other countries, and particularly the EU, who help staff our NHS, look after our elderly relatives, and help keep the nation fed under incredibly difficult circumstances. We left the EU at the end of January 2020, but the COVID-19 crisis shows what an important role staff from the EU and beyond play in keeping our country running. It has been widely reported that anti-immigrant sentiment was one of the factors which led to the vote to leave the EU, and Brexit made many migrants feel very unwelcome. We hope the current crisis will bring a fresh perspective. Helen Campbell, Secretary of St Albans for Europe, added, "Europe Day symbolises the links, collaborations and friendships that forever bind the UK to European nations on the other side of the Channel, despite Brexit."
Westminster Diary, New Ways of Participating in a Debate. Written by our MP, Daisy Cooper. This week, the hybrid parliament, part physical, part virtual, cleared the next hurdle. Building on Prime Minister's questions last week, MPs quizzed ministers, took part in debates, and even had a practice run at online voting. I asked ministers about the membership of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, and about extending financial support for more pubs and music venues. I also took part in the debate on the fire safety bill, which responds to the Grenfell disaster and which is also relevant to some of our new build blocks here in St Albans. Some things weren't very different at all. The answers I received to my questions were pretty evasive. And, as is often the case, I will have to try another way of getting to the bottom of things. But some things were markedly different. For the parliamentary debates, there was a list, published in advance, with time slots for each speaker. Hardly revolutionary, you might think. What normally happens, however, is that MPs email the Speaker's office and ask to speak in a debate. The Speaker then creates a list and an order for who should speak when, but the list isn't published, it's kept secret. The result is twofold. First, because you don't know where you are on the list, an MP might end up sitting in the chamber for 4 or more hours, not realising that they're so far down they'll never get called at all before debating time runs out. Second, the list isn't fixed. An MP is allowed to bob, meaning jump up and down, to intervene during someone else's allotted time. The MP might do this if they think they're too far down the list to get called, but the Speaker might move you further down the list if he thinks you have been bobbing too much. It's all a bit whimsical and inefficient, but none of that is a problem under this new, transparent, sensible system. Finally, MPs had a trial run of online voting, with the simple motion, "This House prefers spring to autumn." There were some glitches on the first run, but at the second attempt, the ayes had it.
Hearts Jazz organisers are still hopeful of running their annual music festival later this year. Before coronavirus stopped gigs, Hearts Jazz staged weekly concerts at the Maltings Arts Theatre in St Albans. The club's 10th Hearts Jazz Festival is due to take place at the Rhodes Arts Complex in Bishop Stortford from Friday, October the 9th to Sunday, October the 11th. In an update to fans and members, Clark Tracy and the Hearts Jazz team wrote, "Regarding our festival, at this stage we are still planning to go ahead unless things take a downward turn. The prospect of a rosier future by October has been forecast, so it's fingers crossed. The festival features Ronnie Scott's All-Stars, the Simon Spillett Big Band and Darius Brubeck Quartet."
The Auburn Weekend is to be reimagined as an online event this summer because of the COVID-19 emergency. Normally, thousands of people pack St. Albans city centre streets in mid-June for the Auburn Pilgrimage and the Street Festival. Although the lockdown may have eased by then, it is likely that people will still be advised to observe social distancing and avoid large social gatherings. St. Albans District Council has decided to cancel the street party planned for Sunday, June the 21st. The Cathedral's Auburn Pilgrimage on Saturday, June the 20th, will no longer include a parade of giant puppets along St. Peter Street. Both events will be reimagined online instead, so residents can still enjoy one of the most popular weekends of the year. The pilgrimage will include a live streaming of a special service on YouTube, and the online street festival will be hosted on Enjoy St. Albans website at www.enjoystalbans.com. There will be musical performances by local artists, art and craft workshops, and educational content.
Residents join Volunteer Army to help out during pandemic. Volunteers from across the district have been helping to keep the country's most at-risk residents safe in their homes, as well as providing vital support and advice for other families and individuals. Since the start of April, around 14,000 food parcels and 500 prescriptions have been delivered to shielded individuals asked by the government to stay at home because they would be at most risk of becoming seriously ill should they contract coronavirus. A further 1,700 food parcels have been supplied to district councils, food banks and other local charities. A community hub has been set up where both fresh and non-perishable food, toiletries and cleaning products are packed by staff and volunteers and delivered to hundreds of people and some voluntary organisations across the county every day. Staff and suppliers have on occasion worked through the night and weekends to make sure that those people most in need have the essential items to keep them healthy at home. Help has also been at hand for residents who need it, but who do not fall into the shielded category. This includes those with underlying medical conditions, pregnant women, people experiencing financial difficulties, and anyone who has lost their usual network or friends and family because of the impact of coronavirus. Hearts Help, a local network of organisations offering support and guidance for those who need it, has stepped up its support. The telephone support service is now available from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week, rather than its usual 5-day-a-week service. Call volumes are up 400% compared to the same time last year, with more than 12,000 individual calls in April alone. People calling in have been offered food parcels, energy vouchers, help to buy essential white goods and clothing, and signposted to other services that can provide financial advice, housing support, and other important information. Alongside the incredible hard work of councils, the military, businesses, voluntary and community organisations, a 10,000-strong band of volunteers has come forward to lend a hand at this difficult time. Coordinated by hashtag Team Hearts Volunteering, many of them are now carrying out a range of important tasks in their communities. This includes things like helping with shopping, picking up prescriptions, telephone befriending, as well as picking and packing food parcels. Katie Waite and Tom Main, who live in St. Albans, are volunteering to pick and pack food parcels in Welwyn Garden City. Katie, who usually volunteers as a guide leader, said, "We have both been furloughed from our jobs, but we wanted to help and do something to get out of the house. We both have family who live alone, and we'd want to feel that they'd be supported at this difficult time, so doing this seemed a perfect fit for us." All the volunteers we're working with are absolutely lovely. There is a nice team atmosphere and it's great to meet new people. What we are doing is so different to our usual day jobs, but it is so rewarding to be part of something like this. We know that the response across Hertfordshire has been amazing, and we want people to know that support is here for those who need it. County Council leader, Councillor David Williams, said, "I would like to say a huge thank you to everyone who is working so hard to help us look after those people who need our help the most at this very difficult time. The response in Hertfordshire has been phenomenal, and I could not be prouder of the way everyone has stepped up to help us tackle coronavirus. There are tricky times ahead, but I would call on everyone to keep up the good work. We will get through this."
And now the list of deaths as announced in this week's Hearts Advertiser. Christopher Sandvoss, age 75. Anthony John Edwards, age 77. Muriel Emily Phipps, 88. David Robert Clark. Anthony Martin Moran, 64. Margaret Lavelle. Joseph Alfred Wallace, 94. And now, a little more music, followed by John reading the national radio listings.
Here are your radio listings to entertain us while we still remain under lockdown. And we'll start with Saturday, May the 9th. The Voyage of St. Louis by Tom Stoppard. Radio 4, 2:45 p.m. This story tells how, a few months before the outbreak of World War II, the St. Louis set out from Germany with more than 900 Jewish refugees on board. The excellent cast includes Toby Jones, Philip Glenister, and Paul Ritter. Still on a World War II theme, Touched by Stephen Lowe, Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m, captures the reality of post-war life for three sisters in the 100 days between VE and VJ days. The opera on 3, Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m, is Janáček's Katia Kabanova. Also at 6:30 p.m, but on Radio 4 Extra, is another chilling tale from The Man in Black. This is immediately followed at 7 p.m. by Barry Cryer's selection of comedy greats, 3 hours of laughs from All Gas and Gaiters to The Likely Lads. At 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4, the next episode of The Poet Laureate Has Gone to His Shed, in which Simon Armitage invites a variety of guests to share chat and sherry. This week's guest is Anthony Gormley. Earlier episodes can be heard on BBC Sounds, each one interesting and delightful. Another broadcaster in his garden is Jamie Cullum. Because of our current circumstances, he'll be playing music by some of the performers who should have been at the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, as well as some from previous festivals. He can be heard 8 p.m. on Radio 2. And John Suchet's year-long exploration of Beethoven, The Man Revealed, is at 9 p.m. on Classic FM. On to Sunday, May 10th, and if you missed last Monday's tribute to Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Garden introduces 47 Years Without a Clue at just after midday on Radio 4. The second part of P.G. Woodhouse's Uncle Fred in the Springtime is at 3 p.m, also on Radio 4. Words of Music on Radio 3 at 5:30 p.m. is on the theme of gratitude. Various diary excerpts from 1945 combined with music to evoke that special year. And Sunday night is Music Night at 7 p.m. on Radio 2, an appreciation of Vera Lynn. Four programmes in a row are all on offer on Radio 4, starting at 7:15pm with Just a Minute, then at 7:45, a short story, Dog in a Hole, followed at 8pm by Tim Harford's More or Lees, and finally, and appropriately, at 8:30, Last Word, the celebration of interesting people who have recently passed away. Let's start the week by looking at programmes that are serialised from Monday to Friday, so from Monday, May the 11th. The Book of the Week at 9:45 on Radio 4, and repeated at just after midnight, half past midnight in fact, is Fall of the House of Byron by Emily Brand, a look at how the family of Lord Byron disintegrated within three generations. The 15-minute drama at 10:45am on Radio 4 and repeated at 7pm is Girl with the Pearl Earring by Tracy Chevalier, which tells the story behind Vermeer's famous painting. The composer of the week at noon on Radio 3 is Dora Pejacevic. The continuation of The Street by Anne Petrie, read by Adoja Andoa, can be heard at just after midday on Radio 4 and repeated at 10:45pm each night. All these programmes Monday to Friday, don't forget. The new Autonomy of Melancholy begins a 10-part series at 1:45 on Radio 4. It's a guide to what it is to suffer sadness in the 21st century. And the Full Works concert on Classic FM at 8pm all week marks the anniversary of Florence Nightingale, 1820 to 1910. Monday, May the 11th, Listening Choices start at 3pm on Radio 4 Extra with John Mortimer's play Glasnost with Anna Massey. A 2005 edition of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue is at 6:30 on Radio 4. Dance-related music from Europe is the theme of Radio 3 in Concert at 7:30pm. Composers include Ravel, Bach and Strauss. And those who enjoy Keris Matthews' blues show will find that it's moved to 11pm on Radio 2. The first choice for Tuesday, May the 12th, is The Pebble in Your Pocket at 11am on Radio 4. It explores the reasons why people are fascinated by small stones and what they tell us about the world. The 2:15 drama on Radio 4 is a comedy about the painter Hans Holbein, entitled Hans Holbein's Skull. The artist is about to begin his painting called The Ambassadors, but this is a tricky time in the reign of Henry VIII. This week's choice of great lives is the Hollywood actress Myna Loy. She was nominated by Sally Phillips and can be heard at 4:30pm on Radio 4. One of those nice listening bundles is available again on Radio 4 Extra this Tuesday, May the 12th, beginning at 5pm with the Stanley Baxter Playhouse. Then at 5:30, My Teenage Diary. After that, at 6pm, A Ghost Story by Walter de la Mare. Then at 6:30, John Suchet's choice of soul music is Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Two comedies for the final hour at 7pm, The Goon Show, and at 7:30pm, J. Kingston Platt's Showbiz Handbook with the late, great Peter Jones. As ever, In Touch is at 8:40 on Radio 4. And Jamie Cullum's Jazz Show at 11pm now on Radio 2. Some breakfast listening to start Wednesday, May 13th. Tim Harford's More or Less is at 9am on Radio 4, followed at 9:45am by Legacy of War, which looks at how wartime legacies have affected the following generations. An absolute treat comes our way at 11:30am also on Radio 4 with Michael Frayn's Magic Mobile. Comedic monologues and duologues are performed by David Suchet, Joanna Lumley and Roger Allam, amongst others. The afternoon concert at 2pm on Radio 3 has works by Britten, Stravinsky and Rachmaninoff. At 2:15 on Radio 4, the drama is Unforgiven, which is a prequel set in 1984 to the TV crime thriller Waking the Dead. Another concert on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. includes works by Elgar and Walton. Grounded with Louis Theroux sees the documentary maker interviewing interesting people during his lockdown at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, and it's Boy George this week. Late night music again on Radio 2 when Mark Radcliffe presents his folk show at 11 p.m. On Thursday, May 14th, Claire Balding begins a new series of ramblings at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. But she's not actually able to go out on an actual ramble, obviously. She celebrates 20 years of the programme by digging into the archive. Another nice clutch of diverse programmes starts at 6 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra with More Ghost Stories by Walter de la Mare, followed at 6:30 by Great Lives, this subject this time Lucille Ball. Round the Horn follows at 7 p.m. and the selection concludes at 7:30 p.m. with I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. Bob Harris's Country Show, now at 11 p.m. on Radio 2. And Friday's listening, Friday, May 15th, begins on a somber note. So far this week, I've avoided mentioning the word coronavirus. But this programme looks really interesting. Pandemic 1918 at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. The three theories about the origins of the Spanish flu are investigated, as are the symptoms, some of which are similar to today's virus. For a delightful contrast, Radio 4's drama at 2:15 is The Life Cycle of the Osprey, the tale of two volunteers set guarding the eggs of the wonderful hawk. More comedy, and yes, unashamedly included a lot this week, is again on offer on Radio 4 Extra, starting at 5 p.m. with Electric Ink, a satirical sitcom set in the newspaper world. At 5:30 p.m, a 2006 edition of Just a Minute. Then a break from humour at 6 p.m. with another ghost story by Walter de la Mare. Off the page at 6:30 has Victoria Corin Mitchell in conversation with Will Self and others. And two comedies to round off this selection, Something to Shout About at 7 p.m. and Never Too Late with the late great Thora Heard at 7:30 p.m. Contrasting music to end this week's choice of listening, the Radio 3 concert, 7:30 p.m, has works by Britten, Elgar and Rachmaninoff, and features Stephen Isserilis on cello. Whilst on Radio 2, Tony Blackburn has his golden hour at 8 p.m. and Gary Davis plays Sounds of the 80s at 9 p.m. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and another enjoyable week of radio listening.
Time now for Nature Notes with Rupert Evershed.
Nature's Way, what will grow in the cracks? What a month. I wrote last month's article on the very brink of lockdown, and now we are plunged into times not previously experienced by this generation or even the one before it. Throughout the latter half of March, a cold and at times strong northeasterly wind has blown, and despite clear skies, has on occasion brought flurries of snow and hail. It has added to that sense of being up against something and has without doubt slowed the passage of our summer visitors from the south. The new world order has stopped us in our tracks, our plans on hold or dismantled. What we really care about has come to the fore, and the rest, well, quite honestly, it can wait. The confinement and strictures placed on us suddenly confer immense value on space and movement, and maybe even solitude. Our garden, if we are lucky enough to have one, the local park or countryside walk have been invested with all the longing and magic we would normally reserve for a summer holiday. With all of this comes the opportunity to reconnect, perhaps at the most basic level with our families and ourselves, but also with the place we live in and the natural world on our doorstep. Outside in nature, it is reassuringly business as usual, and provides a welcome and restorative constancy when all is in turmoil in our man-made world. Never before have our gardens and green spaces held quite so much allure, and of course, if we allow ourselves to be drawn, there is endless fascination to be found. As our roads and transport networks have grown quieter, so it seems the volume of birdsong has increased. Of course, this is normal for springtime, but for once the competing background din has diminished and birdsong, in all its varied glory, rings out across our towns. I can now hear the reply to jousting birds. The wren declares his patch to another wren across the garden, while blackbirds and robins pause to hear their neighbour's response, marking out and defining territorial rights through their songlines. One of the great revelations of birdwatching is to connect a bird with its song. Knowing a bird's song and its varied calls is to be awakened to a secret world of avian conversation and a more deeply woven thread of our landscape's fabric. Follow the song or the call, and you may be surprised by the bird at the end of it. Some of our smallest, most unassuming birds have the loudest, prettiest songs. All that song and dance is, of course, about nesting and raising chicks, and even a short time spent in the garden will begin to reveal where those nests might be. Pigeons and crows makes no secret of their shabby piles of sticks high in the trees, but thrushes and wrens are altogether more secretive. How many nests you have in your garden will largely depend on how much you have been able to resist that peculiarly English obsession of tidiness. Did you leave the messy ivy intact? Did you plug every hole in your eaves? Did you clear that thick, brambly corner of leaves and weeds? Did you fix the broken window in the shed? If so, maybe you put up nest boxes instead, and hopefully your garden will be a home to the next generation of garden birds. It can be an epiphany to recognise our predisposition to tidy in times of stress, and instead to let go and see what nature makes of our mess. I have allowed a flower bed with colourful daffodil clumps to become overgrown with lamium album or white dead nettles, so called because of their resemblance to stinging nettles. Dead nettles are harmless but far from dead. Delicate white ruffs of flowers suffused with green cluster up the dead nettle stems. The daffodils are fine and provide a splash of colour, but the bees love the dead nettles, having no prejudice for weed or cultivar. In these difficult times, while we have lost a bit of control, let's take a leaf out of nature's book and see what grows up between the cracks, and not be too quick to cut it off or patch it up.
Now I'd like to introduce a well-known voice, Alistair Stewart, the journalist, reading his personal view of the Cenotaph War Memorial in London. Particularly poignant, I hope, following the recent anniversary of Victory in Europe Day. This is one of the many interesting items that can be found on the Vocalise London Beyond Sight website.
Hello, I'm Alistair Stewart, and I'm a journalist, and I read the news. I've chosen the Cenotaph, the chunk of white, grey, unpolished stone that is the United Kingdom's National War Memorial, for the perfect way I think its minimalism fits it for that role. And also for what it means to me, both professionally and personally. The Cenotaph is at the lower end of Whitehall, the half-mile-wide thoroughfare lined with government offices, which connects Trafalgar Square to the north with Parliament Square to the south, parallel with the Thames, just to the east. The monument stands proudly in the middle of the two-way road, as if on an island in its own river of traffic and pedestrians, like the support for a non-existent bridge. Because of its position, it's in full view of many of the buildings at the hub of British power. The Ministry of Defence and Downing Street are both close by. You can reach the Cenotaph safely via the traffic lights and pedestrian crossings at each end of its island. And unless there's a ceremony going on, you should be able to move round it and touch it. Just so you know, it's centred on a shallow, pale stone, three-tiered dais. There are usually poppy wreaths on the top level, and against the sides of the monument itself are real flags. The Cenotaph is a four-sided column, 35 feet high on an oblong base, 15 feet by 8.5 feet, aligned long ways down the street. It's like a tapering stack of huge rectangular blocks, the footprint of each a few inches smaller than the one beneath, resulting in a terraced effect. You could say it's a cross between a ziggurat and an Art Deco skyscraper. But to me, it has something peculiarly First World War about it, reminding me of an empty gun emplacement. There are three distinct sections. The bottom section ends at head height, with horizontal lines of bulge and groove like cornicing. The central section is by far the tallest, and the whole monument is topped by what looks like a sarcophagus. Cenotaph in Greek literally means empty tomb. The ancient Greeks believed a proper tomb burial was essential, even if the actual body was missing. And it's a Greek architectural tradition that's partly responsible for another of the cenotaph's features. The way it seems to be solidly rooted to the spot, yet at the same time soaring upwards. The four sides of the column at first appear to be vertical, but in fact they lean, almost imperceptibly, toward each other. If they continued on up, they would eventually meet 1,000 feet into the sky. And they are, even more imperceptibly, convex. The sheer surfaces of the cenotaph are almost entirely free from adornment. What little there is mostly on the shorter sides, facing Parliament Square to the south and Trafalgar Square to the north. Inscribed on each of these sides, just above the cornicing, centred one above the other, are three words, in simple 5-inch square uppercase letters. The Glorious Dead. Above, at the top of the tall central section, is a circular laurel wreath in relief, 5 feet in diameter, carved as if suspended between two roundels by thin ribbon. Directly above each wreath are two lines of Roman numerals. On the south end, MCMXIV, 1914. And on the north, MCMXIX, 1919, the dates of the First World War. The cenotaph was designed by Sir Edwin Lutyens in 1919 to commemorate the British and Commonwealth servicemen and women who sacrificed their lives in that war. Its terrible simplicity is in such extraordinary disproportion to the loss and horror it represents, literally millions sent to their deaths. And I find so poignant the way it rises up without apology, in honest recognition of something that went wrong, not in some out-of-the-way field, but at the very heart of where we do our politics and crown our kings and queens. On the long west and east sides are the dates of the Second World War. They were added later, but scarcely interrupt the bare severity of Lutyens' original concept. Protruding slightly from the stone are the smooth, curved edges of seashells. Millions of years ago, these lay on a subtropical seabed, which eventually hardened into this limestone, known as Portland Stone, after the place in Dorset where it's quarried. The cenotaph contrasts starkly with the elaborate styles of the architecture around it, but its stone gives it a sense of belonging, echoing the Portland Stone of the National Gallery and other buildings nearby. Portland stone is both resilient and easy to work. But Lutyens had another reason for choosing it. It had built the British Empire. Against each long side of the monument, evenly spaced as if standing to attention, are three 15-foot gold-plated flagpoles, their bases in the cornicing at head height. From each hangs a huge, colourful flag representing a service of the British Armed Forces. The flags include one that's pale blue with a red, white and blue roundel. The ensign of the Royal Air Force. My father's flag. RAF Group Captain Jimmy Stewart had trained as a navigator in Canada, catching the end of the Second World War, flying mosquitoes over Germany. It was whilst he was in the RAF that he met my mother, a young Wren telephonist. I remember great arguments with my father over nuclear disarmament when I was a lefty student wanting to ban the bomb. In 1989, when I covered the Berlin Wall coming down, I had to admit he was right. We'd got to this point without killing each other, after all. The flags and poppy wreaths also remind me of the tremendously moving gathering every November when the cenotaph becomes the focal point of the national service of remembrance. the monarch, prime minister, former prime ministers, party leaders, the foreign secretary, leaders of the different faiths, and thousands of representatives from military and civilian callings all come together in comradeship to pay their respects. After the ceremony, the mood lightens as the massed bands strike up the veterans' march past. This is organised by the Royal British Legion, the nation's custodian of remembrance. My mother was closely involved with its work, providing support to service personnel past and present, and their families. And it's the charity that I've been associated with the longest. I help with fundraising, particularly for younger people, widows from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and children whose parents didn't come back. So for me, the cenotaph has deeply personal resonances. It's a monument of national significance, but I think its brilliance is that, at the same time, we can each make it our own. Lutyens could have given us a fussy victory arch, smothered in faces and names of great battles. But instead, we have the antithesis of that. Minimalist. Even abstract. Architecture and sculpture at their absolute best. It's all about what it's not. Our minds are cleared by its purity. We focus without distraction on the enormity of war. It invites us in, providing a space for our own thoughts and recollections of loved ones. It's what we bring to it that ensures those we remember with such gratitude and affection are never forgotten. It shivers my spine. It brings truth to the pledge. We will remember them.
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Piano Swing Blues by Gothby. Before we finish, I'd like to read for you part of a 1963 guide to St Albans, rediscovered by Peyton Books in 2011, and suggested to me by Susan Everest. St Albans in the Swinging Sixties. This is an edited-down version of an original 1963 guide to St Albans. Most of the city's unchanged ancient history, Verulamium and the Cathedral, has been left out in order to concentrate on the city as it was in the mid-1960s. In 2005, Peyton Books, remember them, published an edited facsimile of St Albans, the story of the city and its people in the 1950s. In the immediate post-war years, the country was still recovering from 6 years of war, and an overall greyness pervaded, alleviated only by the Festival of Britain in 1951, and the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1952, both harbingers of a brighter future. This is an edited version of the 1963 guide, published by Peyton Books in 2011, with the permission of St Albans and District Council, and it gives some idea of the changes that occurred over the intervening years. Sadly, I can remember a time when St Albans had several bookshops. Now we only have Books on the Hill and Waterstones, and even they have lost their apostrophe. There was rapid post-war housing development, but a marked decline in local manufacturing. The 1960s heralded the space age, and listeners to BBC Radio's series Journey into Space in the 1950s saw fiction become reality when man first ventured into space in 1961 and then set foot on the moon in 1969. England won the World Cup against Germany in 1966, and in 1969 British pride soared to new heights when Concorde went supersonic. The establishment was rocked by the Profumo Christine Keeler scandal, and a shadow was cast over the world's future in 1962 by the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Russia began constructing missile sites in Cuba, which would have brought them within range of targets in the USA. The 1960s are mostly remembered for the changes in youth culture, music and fashion in particular. There was a breakaway from the more conservative previous generation with a more carefree, casual and happy-go-lucky attitude. For the first half of the 20th century, men's fashion had remained static, until the teddy boy retro dress style of the 1950s gave way to colourful men's designs, available first in the boutiques of the King's Road, Chelsea and Carnaby Street, then spreading throughout shopping malls in Britain. For women, Mary Quant and Twiggy, amongst others, were trendsetters. It was the age of flower power, long hair, winkle pickers and flares. 1967 was the summer of love in San Francisco. Morals, too, were relaxed. Someone once remarked that the 60s were the decade of peace, love and getting stoned. In the late 50s, rock and roll hit Britain, and this ushered in many homegrown singers and groups, such as the Beatles, Rolling Stones, the Kinks and later Jimi Hendrix. Each week, television shows such as Top of the Pops, Jukebox Jury and Ready Steady Go were watched by millions, mostly on rented televisions or bought on the Never Never. Higher purchase. In St Albans, you could pop into Mark Green's record shop in Checker Street and buy singles, EPs and LPs, and then play them at home on your Dansett portable record player. All treble, no bass. Although the BBC radio stations played a certain amount of pop, from 1964, youngsters preferred to listen to Radio Caroline, a pirate radio station broadcasting off the English coast. The interest in rock, blues and folk music was reflected in the number of local bands that performed in St Albans pubs and halls. The Peahen, for instance, held weekly folk club meetings. There were once three cinemas in St Albans. Currently, there are none active. But remember, this was written in 1963, and now, thank goodness, we have the Odyssey. During 1968, both the Abbey Theatre and the Auburn Arena opened, the former at the bottom of Holywell Hill, the latter in the town centre. In the 1960s, we were still dealing in pounds, shillings and pence. Remember threepenny bits, half-crowns, £1 notes and 10-shilling notes. The first decimal coin sets became available in 1968, and the changeover eventually took place in 1971. Although refrigerators were commonplace, there were still no dishwashers or microwave ovens. There were no mobile phones. Instead, telephone boxes, complete with directories, dotted around town. During the early 60s, the Beeching Plan brought about the closure of 5,000 miles of rail track and 2,000 stations, thus sending more people onto the roads. The St Albans Abbey branch only just escaped closure. The number of cars nationally quadrupled between 1951 and 1964, and there was frantic building of motorways to prevent major towns from hemorrhaging. The M1 London to Birmingham motorway, with a turn-off for St Albans, had opened in 1959, and there was an expectation that it would relieve St Albans of through traffic. It did not, of course, and the centre of town is still a traffic nightmare. But parking meters and yellow lines were still a few years away. There was even parking available in front of the town hall. In addition to normal traffic, Lambrettas and Vestas, festooned with polished chrome accessories and ridden by Parker-hooded mods, careered around the town, generally harmless, until they swarmed in large numbers down to the coast to clash with black-leathered rockers. The juvenile crime rate in St Albans, interestingly, was low in the 1960s. St Albans is very much a Victorian town, but parts of it quickly embraced the 60s. several thousand council and private homes mushroomed, the former tending to be built on the perimeter of the town, right up against the greenbelt that girdled and contained the city. There were fears of St Albans turning into any town, but thanks to Mayoress Elsie Toms and the St Albans Civic Society, set up in 1961, the preservation of historic buildings and the curbing of potential carbuncles was, for a time, kept under control. In addition to housing, supermarkets, new schools and business centres were built. Some of the new buildings were outstanding. St Albans College of Further Education, opened in 1963, was regarded by some as probably one of the best pieces of 60s architecture in the city. Most of it was Grade 2 listed, but the site has since been redeveloped. For many years, St Albans had high employment with a flourishing and unobtrusive, non-polluting local manufacturing industry. Perhaps the largest local employers were Marconi Instruments and Bellito Hosiery. Most workers lived within the town, but thousands were employed nearby in the aerospace industry, at de Havilland at Hatfield or Handley Page at nearby Radlett Aerodromes. The accompanying advertisements make interesting reading, but many of the companies and businesses have since disappeared over the intervening years. And this article is attributed to Richard Riding. Now let's have a look at events and birthdays in the past that happened in this upcoming week. On the 10th of May in 1899, Fred Astaire was born in Omaha, Nebraska. Born Frederick Austerlitz, he changed his name to Astaire whilst in a vaudeville act with his sister. On the 12th of May in 1907, actress Katharine Hepburn was born in Hartford, Connecticut. In a long Hollywood career, she received 4 Academy Awards for Best Actress and a further 8 nominations. Stevie Wonder, the singer-songwriter, was born on the 13th of May in 1950. He lost his sight shortly after birth. He signed to the Tamla Motown record label at the age of 11 as Little Stevie Wonder. Andy Murray, the tennis player, was born on the 15th of May 1987. He's of course won Wimbledon twice, as well as Olympic gold. On the 11th of May 868, the earliest surviving printed book was published in China. We know the exact date because it's printed in the book, a Chinese version of a text in the Buddhist tradition. On the 14th of May 1796, the first smallpox vaccination was administered by British physician Edward Jenner. Smallpox now, of course, eradicated throughout the world. And finally, on the 15th of May 1940, the first McDonald's restaurant was opened in San Bernardino, close to the legendary Route 66. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Gilly, Steve and Wendy for reading the news with me today, to Angela for providing the radio listenings, and John who read them. Thanks also to Rupert Evershed for his nature notes, and Alistair Stewart for his personal reflections on the cenotaph. Finally, thanks to Susan Everest for bringing my attention to the St Albans 1960s guide. Fascinating. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time, so until then, it's goodbye from me. Please stay safe at home.